Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. For longtime listeners to this program, you know that climate change has been an integral part of our show since its earliest days. In the United States, climate change has become a highly charged political issue, much to the chagrin of the scientific community that's been sounding alarms since the 1970s that have become increasingly dire as our planet warms under the onslaught of human-emitted greenhouse gases. So climate change, scientifically speaking, is a very big deal, but how it's taught in science classrooms across the country is another story. The fact is that for the most part, it's not. Or if it is, it's a watered-down curriculum covered by teachers who aren't well-versed in planetary climate science. Of course, there are exceptional teachers who do a great job of teaching the scientific content while also avoiding the landmines of a polarized nation, which is, of course, reflected by the students in their classrooms. Joining us to talk about all this is investigative journalist Katie Wirth. She's done award-winning work for the PBS program Frontline, covering science and the environment. Her new book, titled Miseducation, How Climate Change is Taught in America, is an in-depth, thoroughly researched accounting of what is actually happening in classrooms across the country. Katie Wirth, welcome to Blue Dot.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I think a subtitle of your subtitle could be also How Climate Change is Not Taught in America.
Yeah. We found both. We found that in some places, kids are getting a pretty robust education about the climate crisis. And then in other places, they're learning almost nothing about it, or they're actually learning misinformation about it.
One of the opening parts of your book that I really could relate to was you went to visit your alma mater, Chico Junior High School, and you had a really interesting experience there with a science teacher named Kristen. I'm wondering if you would relate that to us.
Yeah, so this is a sixth grade science teacher, and she has for years taught climate science as part of her curriculum, including modern climate science. The atmosphere is warming because we're adding billions of tons of atmosphere warming chemicals to it every year, and what that might mean and some potential solutions. She has the kids work on solutions projects every year. And so, you know, the kids usually get really into this, this unit. And this one year, they started coming in really cranky and like, you know, why are we learning this? This isn't even real. This is dumb. And she, when she got to the bottom of it, she found out that the kids were leaving her classroom and walking into their history class, where the teacher was showing them YouTube videos from a climate denial organization that was saying that climate change is natural and that the idea that it was human-made is this, you know, conspiracy by scientists. So they were getting really mixed messages about that in, you know, from one class to the other. She wound up confronting the history teacher, saying, look, this is my curriculum. Like, I'm supposed to be teaching this, and it's not your curriculum. And we also have to be really careful when one adult says one thing to these 11-year-olds, and then they hear another adult say, well, don't worry about it. You know, they're 11, and that's confusing for them. And he said, well, I just want them to know both sides.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point. And I'll just relate this to you that, you know, I taught science in the same region for 30 years. And I had this much the same experience where I would be teaching a unit on climate change because I had a strong background in planetary atmospheric science. And so I would, you know, go through these lessons with my students explaining how, you know, this is relatively simple physics. And if you look at the planet Venus, it's a cautionary tale. Yeah, you have a runaway greenhouse effect there due to having way too much carbon dioxide, you know, far more than we have. But then they would go to their government teacher and come back to me saying, well, you know, Mr. So-and-so, who actually is a good friend of mine, a great guy, love the guy, would be telling them, you know, oh no, you know, there's another side of it. It's a hoax. Or if I talk to, say, my principal, he would say, when I would tell him, you know, the facts are that the vast majority of climate scientists, I mean, and when I say vast, I mean with a capital V, think that this is a major problem. And he would just counter that with, you know, well, there's always another side, you know, to the issue. And that really becomes the crux of the biscuit, as it were.
Yeah. I'm so interested in hearing how did you navigate that with both your principal and with the other teacher and with your students, most importantly.
It's always difficult for me because they're my friends and I love them and they're good people. You know, these are very good people.
Yeah.
But they have been, over the years, steadily given this point of view that there's two sides to the story, and I know where it comes from. You know where it comes from. This miseducation is coming directly from the petrochemical industry and these think tanks like the Heartland Institute that send this information out. So, you know, what media that they are consuming as conservatives, you know, and I would say, like, in my school, most of my friends, you would call our staff 85% red state and maybe 15% blue state. Wow. So, you know, that's what you're dealing with. And like I said, they're good people, but they've been, you know, misinformed and accepted it, you know, and you know a lot of the background to that. Could you maybe share some of what you found about that?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, the history is really interesting because, you know, people think of climate change as this new topic, and it is, you know, in the great grand scheme of things, but actually climate change was first theorized about in the 19th century, and then there was evidence of it early in the 20th century, and then all these scientists started getting worried about it enough that they created this report for the president in the 1950s, including, you know, some of those scientists, many of the scientists actually worked for the fossil fuel industry because of the Shell Oil and American Petroleum Institute and all of those institutes, or all of those companies had a lot of scientists working for them, and they were studying this because it was important for their own business. And so, yeah, it became pretty clear, you know, 75 years ago or so, that this was going to be happening. And the extent of it has been refined over the course of years. And as you point out, it's not that complicated. You know, it's like, you know, there are certain gases that warm the atmosphere, and we are pumping them into the atmosphere. And so that, you know, it doesn't take a super genius to figure out what happens next. So yeah,
at an astonishing rate.
Right, exactly. 4.5 billion tons of it a year of carbon dioxide is what I was reading recently. So there's that history. And, you know, and it's often cited that 97% of scientists agree about the human cause of climate change. So that statistic was from about 20 years ago. And actually, after that, they went back and looked at those 3% and found that those studies were filled with methodological errors. So, you know, even at the time, that was kind of a questionable statistic, because truly there's no other line of evidence that there's anything else that can be held responsible for the recent warming. But in 2019, there was a study that looked at every single peer-reviewed study in climatology and what they all attributed recent warming to, and 100% of them said that it was human caused. So we're now basically at 100% consensus among the people who study this issue that there's nothing else that we can possibly blame for this problem. It's not partly natural and partly human. All of the recent warming can be attributed to humans. So just to lay that groundwork, you know, we're talking about something that has been studied so rigorously for so long, and like all of the models have borne out exactly as we would expect them. This is not like a hypothetical futuristic problem anymore. It's like happening to us all around us. So that is the kind of reality of the situation. But, you know, that reality has some consequences for a lot of people, and including the fossil fuel industry. Because if you kind of like take the problem to its logical end, you know, you have to stop putting these chemicals into the atmosphere. And that means not burning fossil fuels. And that means leaving coal and oil and gas in the ground. And that means trillions and trillions of dollars of profits that won't be made if it's not taken, extracted and sold, right? Just to kind of wrap it up, what happened next was in the late 80s and early 90s, the oil and gas and coal industry just fired all of its scientists and hired a bunch of marketing people. And they started pushing this idea that the science was in doubt, that we didn't really know what was going on, that it was too early to say, that we still need to do a lot of homework before we figure it out, which is not reflective of the science. But they did it because, you know, if you can get enough people to doubt whether it's even happening, or that whether anything can be done about it, whether humans are even causing it, then you kind of inoculate against drastic action, because drastic action comes at a cost, right? So if there's even a sliver of doubt that it will be worth it, then you're not going to regulate. So they started this campaign to make people doubt climate change, and it has worked.
Yeah. And there's, you know, a very human psychological element to all this, is that it's a lot easier to accept that, oh, this is a hoax, that there really is no problem here. And then you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah,
and absolutely. We see the same kinds of things happening, you know, with the pandemic right now and vaccines and things like that. It's just, you know, psychologically easier if you don't accept the science, because then you have to actually do something about it.
Right. Yeah. And you know, and it's devastating. This problem is devastating, and it's easy to start feeling down about. So there is real motivation to want to think that it's not happening, because, you know, it's just really hard to cope with. We're kind of easy targets for that kind of campaign because of wishful thinking.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with investigative journalist Katie Wirth about her new book, Miseducation: How Climate Change is Taught in America. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. If you're just joining us, our guest is award-winning journalist Katie Wirth, and we're talking about how climate change is taught, or in many cases not, in U.S. K-12 classrooms.
So one of the origin stories of this book occurred in the Marshall Islands. So I worked for about 6 years as a reporter for the PBS investigative series Frontline. And one of the assignments I had while I was there was to go to the Marshall Islands and do a story about climate change. And for those people who don't know, the Marshall Islands is this nation that is in the middle of the Pacific. It's famously very low-lying, like the highest altitude on the island is like 12 feet above sea level. So just a little bit of sea level rise and you get problems. And so it's one of a handful of nations whose very existence is threatened by climate change. So we were sent there and we started talking to kids there, and we were just stunned by how much these kids knew about climate change. Like, you know, we'd be talking to like a 12-year-old and they could talk about like what was causing climate change, what it might mean for their island and for the rest of the planet, what it might mean for their future. Like, it was something that they gave thought to and that was because they were learning about it in school every year, because it's a big issue there. And so one of the kids that we were talking to was this 9-year-old named Iserman, and he, his family was thinking about moving to Oklahoma, where they had some extended family. And part of the reason was because they wanted Iserman and his siblings to get as good an education as possible. And they thought maybe the education would be better in Oklahoma than it was in the Marshall Islands. So the question arose, well, what would Iserman learn in Oklahoma about climate change? And that sort of became one of the animating questions of this reporting.
And what did you find when you went to Oklahoma to investigate that?
Well, I went to Oklahoma, went to Enid, Oklahoma, which is the town that they were thinking about moving to. And I went to Enid High School and I talked to five members of the school's Islander Club. So these were all kids whose families hailed from the Marshall Islands and elsewhere in the Pacific. And of the five kids I spoke to, four of them told me that I was the first adult to ever say the words climate change on school grounds to them. Like they had just never heard it in school. And, you know, and they were mad about it. They wanted to be, they knew from their families and from other sources of information that it was a big deal, that it was happening. It was a big deal, but they were not learning about it in school.
Yeah. And as you traveled the country investigating this, what were some of the attitudes you found, you know, the variety of attitudes from students and where they're getting their points of view from?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the students were like those kids in Enid, where they're like, they have a sense that there's something going on. And we know that kids care about this if they know about it. You know, like the surveys show that young people really care about this issue more than their parents do, more than their grandparents do. And they're willing to take action about it. So yeah, so some kids are really wanting to know about it and are mad that they're not learning about it. And then there's a lot of other kids who have heard from the people in their lives that it's a hoax, that it's not real, that it's exaggerated. And then they show up in classes where it is being taught and they push back. And they say, well, you know, why are we learning about this? I don't think it's real. Or my grandma said that, you know, we don't believe in this stuff. And we laugh about it when we're at home, you know, so it's like they're getting these messages. I mean, children live in the adult world and absorb adult opinions, especially from the most important people in their lives. So there certainly is a pretty big contingent of young people who have that doubtful perspective on it.
And it's interesting, when you say that, I was thinking about a part of your book that struck me as very powerful, is that, you know, politics comes so into play into this topic, and it's kind of strange that it should, because, you know, the basic chemistry and physics behind global warming, planetary warming, and the cause of it, which is us, it's not that complicated, but the politics in this country has... pardon my expression, polluted that.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly true. You know, I think, I mean, actually the surveys show that conservative folks, you know, the majority do trust the science and do think that there's a problem. And, you know, more and more so, because it's really hard to keep pretending that it doesn't exist when it's happening right outside your door. And anyone who has a relationship with their land, with their community, you know, can see that there's something going on, right? But that doesn't seem to filter up to the policy decisions of the leadership of their party. And there's like a real attachment to kind of free market fundamentalism, where, you know, they don't believe in regulation. They think the markets will solve all of this and that we shouldn't meddle with something that is working for the economy.
Yeah. But so to translate that though into the classroom, it becomes, you know, all of a sudden when politics and political points of view come into the classroom for a science teacher, that creates real dilemma for any teacher, because you really don't want to be involving yourself in controversy, you know, as a teacher. You don't want a bunch of parents or your administrators mad at you.
Yeah, well, you know, I saw it handled really beautifully in some circumstances that pushback, including one that happened in Chico right after the campfire. So you know, as all of your listeners will know, the campfire burned down Paradise and all those schools got displaced into Chico. And I spent a couple of weeks in a Paradise Intermediate School when it was displaced into the old Osh building in Chico. And the seventh grade science teacher every year taught a unit on climate change. And that year he was teaching a unit on climate change to a group of kids who could arguably be called climate refugees, because, you know, as much as PG&E was responsible for that, for sparking that fire, it would not have been as devastating had it not been the five hottest summers in a row, you know, the five previous years, and had it rained more than a fifth of an inch over the last 6 months and so on. So one of the kids, he's teaching this unit, and one of the kids raises his hand and says, you know, my parents say that it's not real and I don't know what to believe. And they also told me not to argue with the teacher. And so the teacher, you know, I bring this up because I think he handled it so beautifully. He said, well, you know, like, it's confusing when you hear different points of view about about something, and one person tells you one thing and somebody else tells you something else. And that can be really hard. I'm not here to tell you what to think. I'm here, we're doing science in this class, and I'm just here to give you the best data and evidence that I can. And you get to take a look at it and decide what you think and do your own analysis. And that's what science is. It's discovery. It's looking at evidence and trying to understand the world. And it's not me telling you what to think. And, I think that was just a really nice way to sidestep the politics. He wasn't saying, well, your parents are wrong, you know, which they were wrong in this case about this one issue. But he was saying, kind of empowering the student to think for himself about this issue. And, you know, he may not have in that moment, he may have landed on his parents' side of the issue, but that might have like planted a little bit of a seed and a little bit of an understanding of how science works.
Yeah, because as I recall from reading in your book, he comments at the end that he still doesn't see that climate change is affecting his life, even though it dramatically just has. But as you say, you know, he's just a kid, and as years go by and, you know, and he observes the change going on around him, and he's going to remember that respectful way that teacher dealt with him. And I think that is a huge takeaway.
Yeah, absolutely. That respect is so essential, I think, in a classroom, you know, in any setting. And it's certainly not the children's fault that they're getting these mixed messages. And so handling it in that kind of gentle way that doesn't directly engage in the politics, I think is probably key. I'm curious if you ran into that with your students and how you handled it.
Oh, sure. And, you know, at times, probably not as well as that teacher, because my back would get up. I will say that, you know, back in the 1980s, when I was a student at California State University of Chico, studying this issue with my astronomy professor, Dr. James Regas, who taught us about, you know, planetary atmospheres and how pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere was a really bad idea. That as I became a new teacher in the 90s, you know, I was teaching about this, you know, right away. And wow. I used to show a documentary called After the Warming by James Burke.
Wow.
Which showed what the world would look like in 2020. And, you know, as I think back on it, they may have underestimated how things are going. But I do recall a student back then, and I'll never forget this, a nice kid, his name was Mitchell. And he just said to me after, you know, I presented all this information and explained the physics and the chemistry and just, you know, hey, this, you can't do this without this happening. He said, well, I just can't believe that humans can cause, you know, change on that scale to something as big as the atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the sky because they don't have a real sense of how fragile and tiny our planetary atmosphere really is.
Right. Yeah, you know, I've heard that a lot, that it's, you know, it's hubris to say that humans could possibly change the atmosphere. But, you know, think about how much we've changed the earth, you know, like the, not the atmosphere, but the land, you know, and what the terrain looked like around you, you know, 1,000 years ago versus today. So yeah, I mean, I think that that is a, that's actually a pretty common refrain 30 years after he said it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I told him was that I said, look, cyanobacteria is a lot smaller than you are, but it pumped our atmosphere full of oxygen and made life as you know it possible.
Huh. Wow. Yeah, that's a good point.
What I'd really like to talk about next is something that also fascinated me back then was, and I didn't really have to deal with this because I was not a biology teacher, but observing it was interesting, was how evolution was being, you know, attacked in the school systems, and how climate change somehow got folded into that attack structure. And you go into this in some detail. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, most people have heard of the Scopes monkey trial, you know, where a teacher named John Scopes in Tennessee was prosecuted because the state had just passed the Butler Act outlawing teachers from telling students about evolution, about human evolution specifically. So that kicked off this kind of century-long war over what should be taught about evolution. So how that was decided was in the courts, because in our First Amendment, we have enshrined in that First Amendment the separation of church and state. And so the courts over and over again ruled like, well, you can't teach creationism in a science classroom, because that's a biblical interpretation. That's an interpretation of scripture, effectively. And that doesn't belong in a public school in this country, in the system that we have. So, you know, slowly over, you know, but it wasn't until 2005 that, you know, the last iteration of that creationism was kicked out of school. That was intelligent design. So this idea that some intelligent agency, unnamed and not described as God, but like created life forms fully formed, intact, rather than life forms evolving one from the other. So the courts in 2005 said, nope, not even intelligent design can be in science class. It can be in your church. It could be even in like a theology class if you have one, but it can't be in science class because there's not scientific evidence for it. So, so after that, what happened was the creationism movement kind of reinvented itself again, and it started pushing what are called academic freedom acts. And there was a model bill, and it was sent to lawmakers all over the country, and lawmakers proposed it in something like 75 times in 20 states, and they're still proposing it. Every year, there's a couple states where this pops up. And these academic freedom bills say that a teacher cannot be disciplined if they present the full range of scientific perspectives on controversial subjects such as the origins of life and climate change or global warming. So global warming makes that list of, quote, controversial subjects that teachers can, you know, whatever they say about them, can, you know, they can't really be disciplined. And it says, you know, full range of, you know, I mean, it's like, it's fairly, you know, it's debatable exactly how that would actually play out in a classroom, but there's no question that the purpose is to protect the teachers who want to not teach the consensus. So yeah, they sort of like glommed the two issues together. And, you know, evolution is not, people who, you know, religion, they're not motivated by the same thing. Like climate denial and creationists are not motivated by the same thing. Climate denial is motivated by this like kind of free market fundamentalism, and creationists are motivated by this interpretation of scripture, which, so they're not like necessarily allies, but in this particular way, they kind of join forces because the creationists saw sort of a legitimacy in the, if they add climate change in it, then it's not just about this religious issue. It's about, quote, controversial issues. And, you know, the climate denial folks saw power and getting, you know, there's like this whole grassroots network of people who are pushing against evolution all over the country. So they sort of like joined forces and are now very much paired in these fights over science education.
Okay, well, let's talk about where kids get their information from, which is, you know, in their science classroom. A lot of it has to do with, one, you know, how well trained their teachers are. And if you're talking about elementary school, I would say, from my experience, which is pretty vast, most elementary school teachers have a very, very poor science training, and at least up until this point, it's improving because of the new next generation science standards. But let's talk a bit about textbooks and the materials that get sent out to teachers, because as a teacher, you know, if you get sent something free in the mail and it looks pretty neat, you know, that's, you know, that's a couple days of instruction and the list looks great. Talk about some of the things that they get, that teachers across America have been sent from sources that aren't necessarily in line with climate scientists.
There is a lot of materials out there that, you know, educational materials that have been created by all kinds of interests. You know, there's a big advantage of getting in classrooms for these either ideologically driven organizations or private business. So there's this kind of long history of fossil fuel companies finding or creating classroom materials and providing it for free to teachers. And, you know, that still happens. There's organizations in most states anyway, that are funded by the fossil fuel industry and will provide teachers training and how to talk about energy and free field trips for students to go check out the petroleum museum or the nearest oil derrick, or, you know, like there's all kinds of things that, you know, the industry offers basically.
Yeah. And I even saw some of the stuff in your book about like the kind of cartoon characters they send out for, you know, in their things for little kids to read about, like Petro Pete, you know,
right.
It makes it seem, you know, very warm and friendly for kids.
Yeah, yeah, that's in Oklahoma. There's a state agency, what's called a privatized state agency, which I didn't even know was a thing until this, but it's called the Oklahoma Energy Resources Board, and they create education. They're funded by a voluntary tax on the Oklahoma energy industry, and they create educational materials. And one of them is a series of storybooks for 5, 6, 7-year-olds. Featuring characters like Petro Pete, who, you know, in one of these storybooks wakes up and, you know, one day and he's missing his toothbrush and he's missing his bike tires. And eventually he realizes that what's happened is that he's missing all of his petroleum products that day. And he says, wow, not having petroleum products is a nightmare. And then he wakes up and it was all just a big bad dream. So like, that's a storybook that sits in, I believe, in almost every elementary school in Oklahoma, right? And it's insidious because, sure, yes, we are all very dependent on petroleum products. That's not untrue. And they are important in our lives. They have been important in the development of this country. There's no denying that. But it's not painting a whole picture of both the costs and benefits of the industry.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue talking about climate education for American school students with investigative journalist Katie Wirth. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to my conversation with Katie Wirth about her new book, Miseducation: How Climate Change is Taught in America. And let's talk about the textbook companies, because they make a lot of money off of selling textbooks to school districts across the country. And for a lot of teachers, the textbook is kind of their go-to source of information. How have textbooks evolved or not, you know, in your findings?
So textbooks are so interesting to me because they sit in pretty much every classroom in the country, and, you know, 93% of science teachers say they use them at some point in the year. Some class, we've all been in the class where the teacher really, really relied on the textbook, and pretty much we just read through it the whole, you know, that was the main curriculum. So, you know, in some classes, the textbook is a really important part of the curriculum. So I was wondering, what do today's science textbooks say about this issue that's probably the number one science issue of the 21st century? It's certainly the one that's going to affect our lives the most. And so, you know, I read through dozens of textbooks, all of the most popular ones in the country. And what I found is that almost all of them did mention climate change, and they would give some real reasonable and accurate information about it, but it would almost always come with a caveat of some kind. So it would say things like, well, most scientists agree that, you know, humans are causing climate change. Some think that it's natural and that it's solar, you know, things that actually have never had, there's never been any evidence that solar flares, you know, might be causing the recent warming, but they say that in the textbook nonetheless. And, you know, like one of the most popular textbooks in California until the most recent adoption said, you know, climate change could have some positive effects and some less positive effects, as though all of the effects are going to be positive, just some are going to be less positive. So it's things like that that are, you know, like pretty, they do influence how kids think about these issues. And, you know, because we think of textbooks as authority figures, but the people that I talk to who work for the textbook companies say, well, we know we knew we needed to put it in the textbooks, but we had to be really careful about how we did, because we have to sell textbooks in Texas and other conservative places. And so we had to make sure we could say these few things, but we had to also include, quote, the other side. So so yeah, it's very it's really kind of watered down what's in our textbooks.
Yeah, and you just mentioned, and we talked about it earlier, the other side. One of the things I found interesting in the book was the notion that, and then I could see a lot of teachers, you know, naturally getting sucked into doing this, is that having a debate about climate change isn't really a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated because debate is, and I mean, I'm sure you know more about this than I do, but I think it's usually considered pretty good pedagogy in class. You know, it gets kids thinking and arguing and interacting and kind of, you know, participating. And so, you know, teachers like to have debates in class. But in this case, it's like, imagine if the debate was, do cigarettes cause cancer? You know, and you had kids taking up this each side that they don't. And, you know, kids would walk away from that debate thinking, well, we don't really know. Maybe it is, maybe it doesn't. Scientists still debate it. We're still debating whether or not it does, you know, and that would be doing them a disservice, because the overwhelming evidence is that cancer is caused, or that cigarettes do cause cancer. So it's, you know, it's like, it's the same thing happens when you're asking kids to debate climate change. You're asking them to debate something that scientists don't debate. And you could have them debate like, oh, well, what should we do about it? Should we do anything at all about it? You know, like, and that, what should we do? You know, like, those are things that adults, reasonable adults, can debate, but not, is it, what does, you're not debating like, what does the bulk of the science say? That doesn't serve students. They walk away thinking that it's still debatable.
Yeah, and the media has been, to a large part, responsible for this, although it's gotten better in recent years. In always, you know, if you have a debate on TV, you're going to show both sides. So, and climate change has always had this, like, okay, you know, here's a scientist talking about climate change. Now I have to bring in somebody to counter that person.
Yeah, and that's really misguided. But yes, my industry is absolutely responsible for dropping the ball on that. That, like, they weren't, in many cases, were not actually trying to get at the truth. They were just kind of trying to check off this box called balance. When if you were really trying to do balance, you would have like 1,000 scientists debating one scientist, you know, on that TV, and not one scientist versus another, right? Like that would be reflective of the truth, but that's not how it was portrayed.
Yeah, I think even John Oliver did a piece like this where he brought in like 97 guys to men and women scientists in white coats to debate, you know, this one or two people.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned the next generation science standards, and I'd like to know, to get your point of view on how that they are affecting the way climate change is taught.
So as your listeners probably know, there's no kind of national curriculum in this country. The federal government doesn't say, like, this is what should be taught in our country schools. It's left to states to decide what is taught to their kids. And the way that they do that is they adopt standards. So a standard is just like kind of their expectation of what a kid's going to learn in a given subject in a given grade. So like in fourth grade, they're going to master their multiplication tables or whatever it is. I'm probably getting that grade wrong, but it's, you know, that kind of a determination. So so there was this effort to really update science standards all over the country. And this group of educators came together and really thought about, like, what do we know about how to teach science in the best way and how kids really learn this stuff? And they came up with a set of model standards called the Next Generation Science Standards. And then those started to be proposed state by state, because they're not going to be proposed nationwide. Just each state, you know, these educators went back to their home states and said, like, look, here's some of these really good standards that were developed with a lot of thought. And about 20 states have adopted them pretty verbatim, including California. They're not totally verbatim. They will, you know, there's room to say, like, you know, in our community or in our state, this is what the environment looks like, or, you know, there's some localization of it, but overall it's the same framework. But then there's other states that have adapted it in much more significant ways. Like they've just taken out the climate standards, or they've messed with the evolution standards because those won't fly in their states. And then there's other states like Texas and Florida and Ohio who just, you know, just are sticking with their own standards and refuse to consider the next generation ones.
Hmm. And, you know, the next generation science standards are meant to be interwoven from, you know, K through 12, to give this, you know, strong base of scientific knowledge and how science works and how you do science, instead of just, you know, a bunch of factoids. So I've always thought that they're, you know, they're a great idea, but, you know, it's like anything, how you implement it is what's going to make a difference. And one thing that I would add is just the structure of the way science is taught. You know, in a traditional high school, for example, you would have a biology class to start out with. You know, if you were on, like, say, a college prep track, you're going to go to UC or California State University. You're going to take biology in 9th or 10th grade, and then you're going to take chemistry and then physics. And really, earth science, where you might learn about climate change and geology and, you know, earth history and things like that, or environmental science, those are either electives or, you know, that, or like in the case of earth science, often that's the non-college track course where, you know, that's for the kids that just need to meet their science requirements. So we're going to teach them the basics of earth science and that's it. They're not going, you know, they're not on that track to get to college. So that is not, you know, the kind of course that, you know, is going to be robust, if you will. And environmental science, where, you know, students might learn about natural systems and, you know, that how, you know, how we are affecting them. That really, you know, in your findings, did you see that, you know, you don't see a whole lot of environmental and earth science being taught across the country?
Yeah, I think there was a 2018 study that estimated that about 5% of students take earth science and about 5% take environmental science in high school. I mean, not every school even offers those classes. And then certainly students are directed into biology, chemistry, physics, kind of the big trio, you know? So yeah, you kind of have these, you have this hole, you know, and what was relevant about that to this conversation is that climate science, it actually can fit into any of those sciences. There's elements of it. You could study, you know, it through the lens of chemistry, biology, or physics, but it most naturally fits into earth science and environmental science. And so, you know, what that means is that kids, the last time that all kids get some information about earth science is middle school science, usually, because earth science is part of most states' middle school science standards. And then they may never hear about it again, depending on what classes they take or don't take and how the standards are in their state. So, you know, like figuring out what a given state's middle school science standards say about climate change gives you sort of a lowest common denominator of what a kid could get through school knowing.
Yeah. And if you look at like really new textbooks, you'll see climate change especially in NGSS type textbooks, you'll see those themes woven throughout, let's say, a chemistry textbook or a physics textbook. But, you know, they're kind of there in the periphery. They're not, right. You know, they're not in the core subject matter that you got to master if you're going to, you know, do well in physics.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also worth noting that I was looking at these high school earth science textbooks, and there was one set by Pearson that has, I think, the best-selling high school earth science textbook in the nation. I should check that. I should fact check that, but it's at least one of the most popular. And they have two versions of the same book. It's by the same authors. It has a lot of the same content, but one is kind of for the general audience and one is for the advanced version of the class. And in the kind of general, like, so-called rocks for jocks kind of earth science class, climate change got two pages, and one of those pages was told the students to go look on the internet for various opinions about what is causing climate change. So it was like, go figure out what the internet says about climate change. And then the same book by the same authors for the so-called smart students, the advanced students, had 10 pages on it, on climate change. And there was no equivocating. There was no go look on the internet. It was just information about climate change. And I say so-called smart students because what that actually means in our system is the well-resourced ones usually. And then the less resourced ones are getting the worst, you know, information about the future becomes the domain of these like well-resourced kids and not all kids.
Yeah. Before we wrap this up, if you were to look at, let's say we were to take a student from Ohio or Iowa or anywhere, somewhere in middle America, and plop them down in a school in Europe, say maybe Germany, and vice versa, take a kid from Germany and put them in an American classroom, how stark of a difference would that be?
You know, every country has its own education system, and some do this issue much better than others. But the there was some UN research into this issue, and it's pretty clear that America's addressing of this issue is worse than any other country in North America or Europe or Western Europe anyway. And I actually spent some time in Germany reporting. I was there for the UN climate conference a few years ago, and I was talking to some teachers because I was already interested in this subject. And the German government does mandate that climate change be taught to students. And what's more is they mandate it that it be taught in this way that like frames it as a moral issue. So like, you know, this is happening, and also we have a responsibility to do something about it. It's a moral issue, which certainly would be like, that is not a, that's that, that kind of education is not going to fly in the American public school system.
Yeah. Well, Katie, it was a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah,
and
likewise.
thanks for writing this really powerful book. Great reporting on how climate change is taught in America. I appreciate it.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again to our guest, Katie Wirth. You can find her new book, Miseducation: How Climate Change is Taught in America, through most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram, at @BlueDotNSPR. Our social media coordinator is Angela Osterello. The theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.